The event is really exciting for me, partially because I get to sit here next to Ian Cobain, who's one of my total journalistic heroes and has been for years and years and years. I've actually depended on his work for the initial foray into the project that ended up becoming the book, because he's done a lot of the investigations on the kinds of subjects that's in my book. Ian's been a journalist for more than 30 years, and if any of you guys read Guardian, even very infrequently, you'll know his byline because he writes some of the meatier stuff for the newspaper. His work has included an examination of the UK's involvement in unlawful detention and mistreatment of detainees since September 2001 and in Iraq following the 2003 invasion. He's won the Martha Gellhorn Prize, the Paul Foote Award, and a number of Amnesty International Media Awards, as well as a Human Rights Award from Liberty and a Political Book Award. And he's got this book, Cruel Britannia, which is an extraordinary work of research and writing, which I really strongly recommend. So.
Well, thank you very much. Landon's being far too kind, because, of course, we're actually here to talk about her book. Lala Khalili is Professor of Middle East Politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies. She's the author of a number of works. Her last book before this one, Heroes and Martyrs of Palestine, is clearly about Palestinians. This book, her latest book, Time in the Shadows, is an award-winning study, an absolutely remarkable and exhaustive and award-winning study of the use of confinement in what we occasionally call asymmetric warfare, the way in which liberal states resort not only to the incarceration of combatants, but the way in which they try and control civilian populations through confinement whilst fighting their counterinsurgencies. She investigates two counterinsurgency operations in particular, that mounted by the Israelis and more recently and notoriously, if you like, those mounted by the United States, but also looks at the ancestors of such places as Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, looking at the way in which colonial authorities resorted to confinement. So maybe I can start by asking a really very straightforward question, which is, would be, when and why did you embark upon this study of the use of confinement?
That's a really interesting question. In 2004, I was wrapping up the research on my previous book, which was about Palestinian refugees in refugee camps in Lebanon. And the pictures from Abu Ghraib came out, and particularly the pictures of naked bodies and prisoners having dogs sicked at them, a number of the people that I had interviewed in the camp and was in the process of interviewing told me, this looks like the kind of stuff that happened to us in Israeli prisons in Israel, or in Israeli camps and proxy prisons, particularly notoriously Qiyam prison in Lebanon. Israel had established a number of detainee camps and prisons in Lebanon during its long occupation of various bits of that country. And apparently some of these methods were very familiar to people. And the dog thing in particular got me, because it seemed there are also, if anybody has ever lived in the U.S. or was paying attention to the Civil War era, you're, of course, familiar also with the pictures of white U.S. policemen sicking dogs on black protesters, on African-American protesters in the U.S. So the dog thing really struck me. And then once I started looking at how there seemed to be particular methods that were being used to humiliate people. They weren't outright torture in the way that we think of it, or pulling nails, or which I'd heard about because I had grown up in Iran. But there seemed to be a kind of a method to this madness, a horrifying method, but a method nevertheless. And I think that's when I started looking and reading. And of course, people like you were writing about the pasts of this. And for the first thing that comes up often is Northern Ireland, because of course, when you hear about people being sleepless, people being subjected to long standing or wall standing, being stood against the wall, or being hit, but not in ways that leave marks. Immediately, the instance that comes up is Northern Ireland and the famous case that the Republic of Ireland brought on behalf of the prisoners in the North, Ireland versus England, which went to the European courts, and in the end, it came up with a kind of a wishy-washy response, the courts did, but it established these kinds of methods, and I think that's how the project, it essentially went from there.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the prison you mentioned in southern Lebanon, Khiam prison, which was run by proxy forces?
Yes.
And where some people were detained for extraordinarily long periods of time.
Yeah, Khiam prison was in a town which is on a hill, more or less, if on a clear day, you can actually see clear into Israel. And this town was in a zone that Israel continued to occupy until May 2000. From its invasion in 1982, and which it had invaded previously in 1978. So this prison was established under the aegis of the South Lebanese Army, which was a local, people drawn from the local area, but who had been trained by the Israelis, whose uniforms were given by the Israelis to them, and whose interrogators were trained by the Israelis, whose salaries were paid by the Israelis, and who reported directly to Israeli military and to Amman, Israeli army's intelligence arm. And of course, in addition to Amman, which essentially ran the prison, although at a remove, the Shin Bet, which is the internal security, and Mossad, which is external security, were all interested in the stuff that was going on in there. And yes, people were held in there in horrendous conditions. I mean, this is one of those prisons that it's sort of on the spectrum of horrible prisons. It's somewhere towards the end of how horrible it is. I visited it in 2005 for the first time, so 5 years after it had been liberated, and it smelled like shit still. It smelled like human excrement. It smelled like blood. It smelled like flesh that has been left to rot. The dormitories, which were supposed to sleep, maybe 4 people, slept up to 20 people. There's slop buckets. People had to sleep with their heads next to the toilet, essentially, the slop bucket. And they weren't given any medicine, with the exception of aspirin. So people went through having to have teeth extracted only with aspirin. People who went through appendicitis, and it was only until when they had passed out and they were near death, they were given given aspirin until that point. So it was a pretty, pretty horrendous stuff. What struck me about Khiam, however, is that there were all these really fascinating affidavits. A number of the people who were held in Khiam brought a court case against Israelis in the Israeli court. And a number of affidavits were given by the Israeli military people about the prison, which essentially tried to say it really, we weren't running it, they were running it. But in so doing, they actually, in fact, confirmed that they were paying the people's salaries, that they were, in fact, involved in the interrogations, etc. So it's one of those interesting cases where the legal attempt to distance Israel from the case has produced documents which are extremely useful to people like me, researchers, ex post facto, who want to come and look at what had happened. Khiam is really also interesting because it is one of those instances where it's very clearly a proxy force is running it. Yes, of course Israel was running it, but the Lebanese are very clear about who was involved in the running of that prison, and the names of the torturers and the names of the guards were posted outside of Khiam, which was then destroyed in 2006, targeted. It was not a military target or anything, but Israelis specifically targeted and destroyed it in their 2006 attack in Lebanon. So obviously, it couldn't even stand as a museum. So, it's a really interesting place for that reason, for those reasons.
And you've traced the way in which liberal states have tried to learn from each other, with
yes.
the result that patterns of confinement and also patterns of abuse keep cropping up in different parts of the world at different times in recent history. Could you tell us, you've just touched upon it, people saying, well, I was a prisoner effectively of the Israelis, but what we experienced looked like these photographs.
Yeah.
of Abu Ghraib. Can you tell us a little bit
more
about that?
Yeah, and I actually want you to jump in on this as well, because your book in particular is really incredibly revealing about that, and it reveals stuff that I've, after nearly 10 years of researching in the archives, stuff that I didn't know. So what was really striking to me, as I mentioned Northern Ireland in the case of the US, in the immediate aftermath of that, I came back, and there was one of the interrogators who'd been involved in Abu Ghraib had just written an op-ed in one of the US newspapers repenting from having done this interrogation. He later wrote a book which came out called Fear Up Harsh. His name is Tony Lagaranis. And I immediately contacted him. I have no idea how I got his number, but somebody gave me his number, and I contacted him immediately and started talking to him. And I had a 2-hour-long interview with him. And it was one of the most interesting interviews I had through the course of the whole entire project, perhaps because it was an early interview and it sort of set me up for lots of different things. But one of the things that he told me was, when we are trained, he was working for the U.S. Army, when we were trained in Fort Huachuca in Arizona in the U.S., to do military interrogation training, to do military intelligence, to sort of learn how to do it. We were taught about human rights, we were taught about Geneva Conventions, we were taught about all sorts of different things. But then when we would go for our cigarette break, our instructor would come outside and would say, but you know who's really good at interrogating? It's the Israelis and the British. And so there was... This was the kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing that happens outside of ordinary recorded procedures. So that was really interesting to me, number one. Number two, when you went back to Northern Ireland and started looking at stuff from Northern Ireland, you saw all the people who were involved in Northern Ireland had just come back from Aden in Yemen, what became southern Yemen, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. And those people who'd been in Yemen... or in Aden, had come from Cyprus and Kenya. And the people, counterinsurgencies in Kenya, where Mau Mau was going on, and in Cyprus, EOKO was going on. And those people had come from Malaya, where the Malaysians of Chinese descent were in revolt. And those people had come from Palestine, both 46 to 48, when the Yishuv, the Jewish community, was some segments of it were fighting against the British. But more significantly, from 36 to 39, where the Arab revolt was going on in Palestine. And so it was like unspooling a thread. Pulling a thread, and suddenly the whole thing comes open. But what was really striking about your book was that there's also a very local heritage to this. Local in the sense that stuff was going on in very posh neighbourhoods.
Yes, there was. The British Army had an interrogation centre in Kensington Palace Gardens, which opened in 1940, I think, but didn't close until 1948. And a large number of Germans, hundreds rather than thousands, passed through there, and the initial intention was to extract militarily useful intelligence. From the beginning of 1945, its purpose changed. It became a war crimes investigation centre, and the people were sent there to be partly to be investigated as potential war criminals, but partly to be prepared for their role as prosecution witnesses at war crimes trials. So, for example, if it was felt that an officer in the Waffen-SS had ordered a particular massacre, then one or two of his NCOs would be sent to this place in Kensington Palace Gardens, which had the wonderful name of the London Cage, and they would be prepared in such a way that they would give the evidence that was required of them. And people there were they were subjected to sleep deprivation, extremes of heat and cold. They were beaten. They were whipped. They were forced into stress positions. So that operated between 1940 and 1948. And then MI5 had an interrogation centre near Richmond that operated between 1940 and about 1946. And less is known about what was happening there, although the first people who went there were members of the British Union of Fascists, and they said that whilst they weren't beaten, nobody laid a hand on them. They were roughly handled, but they spent long periods of time being chained into stressful positions, long periods of time in cold, and long periods of time in dark or bright lights. And they were when we finished with them and we sent them off to the Isle of Man or Stafford Prison to be interned for the rest of the war. They were replaced by suspected enemy aliens, including quite a few German spies who were sent there as part of the process of ensuring that they could be turned. They could be turned, and they'd sent back to their handlers by radio messages that were considered to be useful. So less is known about the place that the British ran, although what is known is the guy who was running it then ran a post-war interrogation centre outside Hanover, where the British starved a number of people to death. And that is known because they were dumping their bodies at local hospitals, or sometimes they were dumping emaciated, starving people in local hospitals just before they died. And there was enough concern about this expressed, particularly by members of the Roman Catholic clergy in this area. And in other areas, we had an interrogation centre in Kiel, one in Berlin. We had others in Beirut and Naples in post-war years. And eventually a Scotland Yard detective was sent to investigate. He just investigated the one British post-war interrogation centre at a place called Bad Nendorf, as I say, outside Hanover. And I managed to obtain his report. It was like several old telephone directories, for those of you who remember what a telephone directory is. I managed to obtain it under the Freedom of Information Act, and it's down at Kew. And there were photographs of these inmates who, as this detective observed, looked like they'd just emerged from Belsen. A large number of the photographs had disappeared. They'd fallen behind radiators somewhere in Whitehall departments. But some of the photographs are still there. And as I say, completely different scale, of course, to which the Nazis were doing. But we were starving people to death. We were also employing instruments that we'd recovered from a Gestapo prison in Hamburg. Shin screws, they call them, you know, tightening thing. So that's, and the organisation that ran this place, well, that wasn't MI5 at this time. The guy who'd been running MI5's interrogation centre then went to work. He was by this time working for a division of the War Office called the Combined Services Detailed Interrogation Centre, CISDIC, which had a large number of operations all around the world, not all of them involving the abuse of prisoners, I should stress. But CISDIC had a number of secret prisons which they successfully concealed from the Red Cross. I've mentioned a few. There was also Casablanca. There was one in Cairo. There was one for a while just outside Brussels. And they had their own fleet of aircraft, small fleet of aircraft, used primarily to transport the recordings. They used to record interrogations and bugged conversations in prison cells on sort of shellac discs, and they'd fly those around. They've vanished. I don't know where they are now. But they'd also fly prisoners around. What does that remind you of? The secret network of secret prisons and your own private fleet of aircraft, and everything's concealed from the Red Cross. Reminds me of something anyway. But so I think that's what Lalla was talking about. But also, one of the other things I discovered during my work with The Guardian, we tried to confine considerable numbers of people in Northern Ireland from August 1971, as you know, through executive internment. The devolved Northern Ireland government reintroduced internment in August 1971 with the full encouragement of Ted Heath's government. And I think we tried to pick up about 400 people one morning, but we got 300 and odd because everybody knew it was going to happen, so anybody of any importance wasn't sleeping at home. We picked out initially 12 of those internees, and then later on two more, and subjected them to torture. We tortured them. And they all described what happened when they were being taken to this place. It was an old airfield outside Derry to be tortured. They all described how they were beaten on detention, they were beaten on transport, they were being frightened, they were told that they were going to be thrown out of helicopters. They were stripped on arrival. They had they were given ill-fitting boiler suits to wear. Then they all underwent examination by a doctor, British Army doctor, who very carefully examined and checked their breathing, their heart rate, and then they were considered to be fit for. They were passed as being fit for interrogation. Formally, it was fit for detention, but what it really meant was fit for interrogation. And then the really horrific stuff would start. If you talk to people who were detained by the British Army in southern Iraq between 2003 to 2008, an extraordinary number of them describe being. There were all these Irishmen were hooded. There's an extraordinary number of Iraqis describe being hooded or having blacked out goggles put over their heads, being beaten on detention, beaten on transport, being taken to a place where they were going to be interrogated, and then they'd find that there was a doctor there waiting to examine them. And they wouldn't just test. By this time, the British military doctors weren't just testing breathing and heart rate, and they were taking urine samples and quickly saying, you know, how much sugar there was in the blood and that sort of thing. And then they would be passed as being fit for interrogation. So in 1971, 2003, 2008, very similar practice, really. It's still going on in the same way.
And in fact, today I saw in the New York Times that the American Psychological Association, which is the trade association for psychologists, is actually looking to review the involvement of psychologists in Guantanamo. So it wasn't just the doctors who went against their Hippocratic oaths. What you find in reading some of the transcripts that have been released of the interrogations, or leaked that have been released of the interrogations in Guantanamo, is that there seem to have been a couple of psychologists who were involved in devising the process through which these detainees were broken down. And in fact, in a number of instances, not just broken down, but gone completely mad. In a number of instances, these people have been, their phobias were exploited. They were put into coffin-like spaces. And in all of those instances, psychologists were apparently involved, not only to devise how to go about it, but to also be there just in case, just to push the limit a little bit further, just a little bit further. And I think that that's also what's kind of horrifying to me. And it also seems to be what distinguishes the liberal form of torture and detention from what they do in, say, Russia did in Chechnya, or the Sri Lankans did in the Tamil segments of the country. They just went in and killed people. Whereas it seems that we, here in the UK and in the US, use our doctors and psychologists just to make sure that people stay alive, use tortures that very rarely leave marks except on people's minds. And that, to me, is really, really striking.
You have examined, Lala, the occasions when the confinement operations have been really very ambitious, and very large numbers of sections of population have been held and confined. Malaya, for example, which is, I know next to nothing about the Malayan emergency, but so tell us a little bit about the new village scheme that they have.
The Malayan emergency is probably one of the most interesting, least studied, and least known counterinsurgencies, small wars, in which the British have engaged since the end of the Second World War. It starts off... So Malaya at this point is a British colonial holding. It has just come out of Japanese... it has just come out of Japanese occupation. And in 1948, Chinese communists begin to mobilize among squatters. Now, squatters were landless Chinese peasants, not immigrants from China, but Malayans of Chinese origin, so ethnic Chinese Malayans, who lived near rubber plantations in lands which, as the country was consolidating and moving towards a kind of an independence era, the Malay sultans and Malay landholders wanted control of. Number one. Number two, there was a period of economic crisis in the rubber plantations, and they needed, and then the Korean War starts, and there's suddenly a really high demand for rubber. And so they needed cheap workers to work in the rubber plantations. So an economic impetus and a military one come together. The economic one is, let's get all the Malay people of Chinese origin, all of these squatters, near the rubber plantations so that they can provide free labor or cheap labor, near free labor to plantations. The military impetus is that because the Chinese guerrillas who are fighting in the jungles are recruiting from among these squatters, because these squatters are, of course, they have very real grievances about landlessness, about poverty, about repression, about violence against them, let's separate out the guerrillas from these civilian populations. And so a scheme begins called the New Villages Scheme. And the New Villages Scheme essentially uproots communities of Malayans of Chinese origin, destroys whatever crops or village gardens they have, destroys their cattle, and moves them into areas near these rubber plantations, concentrates them. They were, in fact, the methods that used that were, the British had used in the Boer War with the concentration camps there. So this was a concentration of civilian populations, and these and they were given bamboo and a bit of wood to make themselves huts, some basic foodstuff. But the entire new villages were placed under barbed wire fences, so the entire areas were completely and totally walled in, and had one entry and exit point, and people were searched upon entry and exit, and there were floodlights. So the new villages didn't have electricity, but there were electric floodlights that lit the new villages for military purposes. And whenever the military needed intelligence, they would go to these, the British military needed intelligence, they would go to these new villages and demand intelligence. And if intelligence was refused, or if there had been an operation nearby and near one of these new villages and the new villagers weren't forthcoming about who had been involved, their food rations would be cut. So their rice rations would drop. They weren't given any meat. They were essentially given rice and some vegetables, and they grew some vegetables in sort of kitchen gardens. But it was a method that was that essentially resulted in something between 1.5 to 2 million people being displaced. Now, it's an outrageous number, but exact same thing happened in Kenya with Kikuyu reservations, where reservations were created, again, surrounded, etc. It was the exact same plan that the Americans tried to implement in Vietnam under the name of strategic hamlets, which failed fairly right away. But it has been a plan, and the French used it in Algeria and on a much larger scale. They called it regroupment centers, and something like half the population of the country were moved into this. And pretty much the entire area south of the coastal, mostly urban zone was depopulated, pushed into these regroupment centers. And they were atrocious. Now, this was one of the innovations of counterinsurgency, which has been really striking to me, because when you actually go back and you look at how this works, you see that the methods employed, surveillance, monitoring, punishments, food control, the pushing of people into this, the view of all men between the ages of 15 to 65 as sort of suspect populations, the use of women as potential sources of intelligence, all of these are familiar from other contexts, namely, for example, West Bank and Gaza, and particularly Gaza. And so there, it's a method, it's a particular method of control that has been honed time after time, counterinsurgency after counterinsurgency. And if you actually look also at the ways in which the U.S. fought in Iraq, and you go back and read the Department of Defense in the U.S. is remarkably transparent about the stuff that it has done, which is astonishing. You just have to know where to look, because they have something like 250 websites, which nobody knows about. But they have done all these oral histories about how to fight a war better. So they essentially collected loads, reams and reams and reams and reams. There's volumes of multiple thousands of pages. And in these oral histories, what you run into is that the people, the officers who have become superstars of the U.S. Army, people like Herbert McMaster, not to mention Petraeus, their method was precisely to place entire intransigent towns under lockdown, so push sand berms around them, in some instances put barbed wire all around them. In almost all of these instances where such thing has happened, have one entry and exit point to the city, and have biometric data that controls who comes in and who doesn't come out. And it's astonishing to find that that scheme, the particular scheme of concentrating populations, is being exercised in situ, not displacement in the way that it was in Malaya or Kenya or other subsequent strategic hamlets or Algeria, but it's exercised in situ. So it is something that has gone on and happened again and again and again. And of course, the Americans have very explicitly learned from the British and the French. They name their ancestors very clearly. It's the British and the French.
In Malaya, did it, from the perspective of the British colonial authorities, did it work?
It's interesting because it is called the one counterinsurgency that has succeeded. And One of the other people that I interviewed, a really heroic guy, a U.S. military officer who was one of the first lawyers to take on Guantanamo detainees, and for that reason has been subjected to death threats, has had his promotion cut off, his life has been turned upside down. He was one of the other people that I interviewed along Tony Lagaranis, that other interrogator. And I said to him, but what about Malaya? That is the success. And he said, how is it a success? The British left, didn't they? And so, yes, so I don't know. I mean, it is in a sense, the British, yes, they did leave. But in another sense, it is a success. They left in place a very pliant, good ally that has protected the interests of the U.S. by, for example, not allowing the archives of those days to be revealed.
And you've mentioned the way in which the British attempted to import the new village scheme into Kenya.
Yes.
And that wasn't a success. That was a terribly bloody war of decolonization and involving barbaric acts on all sides, and was seen as being a very shameful event eventually. Why do you think it didn't work in Kenya? Or?
I think Kenya was particularly... I mean, I think I'd like to hear what you think about it, because you've written quite a bit about that as well and the court cases that have come out of that. My sense is that Kenya would have been an impossibility because there was so much going on in Africa, so many decolonizing radical movements going on in Africa at the same time. And Kenya was also a case in which a very brutal settler regime in situ, in Kenya itself, was actually at loggerheads with London. They were doing such horrendous stuff. First of all, the settlers were doing such horrendous stuff that the Kenyan government, the colonial Kenyan government, was ashamed of them. And the colonial, or trying to hide it or whatever, and the colonial Kenyan government was doing such horrendous stuff that you actually hear the voice of exasperation in the archives when you read people in London. Ultimately, I think the cost of keeping that place colonized just became too high, both politically and in real costs. But politically, it was impossible to maintain such brutality in such an ongoing way, especially when news of it started leaking out. When it was, interestingly, ICRC was allowed into some of the Kenyan concentration camps, the pipeline, whereas they weren't allowed into Aden prisons. In Aden. So Kenya also was at the center of a lot of mobilization by African intellectuals here in London, and of course the leader of the sort of opposition, the national movement, Jomo Kenyatta, was he'd been trained here. He had gone to LSE. He had a degree in anthropology from the LSE. And so he had all of these networks of local intellectuals that he mobilized on his behalf. I think it's really important to recognize that in addition to the national movement that was going on there, having these allies in London mattered. Barbara Castle, the MP, the lefty Labour MP, was a huge, significant figure in this. Fenner Brockaway, who is one of the heroes of decolonization, this lefty activist who constantly was involved. These guys were important because these metropolitan figures mobilized news reports, mobilized human rights kind of discourses, although those were not yet quite as frequent. I think those things mattered. I really do. And I think Barbara Castle asking questions in the parliament for the Cypriots, for the Kenyans, for Aden, actually. When you look at the parliament now, there are so few people that are like that now. I can maybe count them on one hand that would ask questions on behalf of... I mean, how many people resigned from the parliament? Robin Cook is the only one I can think of when 2003 happened. It's a very different time. What do you think? What do you think about Kenya?
Well, Kenya, there's been some very good histories of Kenya and the counterinsurgency operation in Kenya published in the last few years by David Anderson, Hugh Bennett, Caroline Elkins, and it struck me when I was reading these to the extent to which they're relying upon oral history techniques and upon fragments of documentary evidence rather than a proper archive. And we now know why that is, of course, because during the during the litigation that was brought on behalf of a small number of former detainees, some of them members of Mau Mau, some of them weren't members of Mau Mau, who were seeking permission to sue the British government over the abuses they said they suffered. So they said it all was accepted by the, eventually it was accepted by the British government that their complaints were true. During the course of that, a number of historians who were working as expert witnesses for the litigants pointed out that they couldn't have had all the documentary evidence. There was gaps in the archive, and one of these historians, a guy called David Anderson, submitted a witness statement saying, "I think you are withholding around 1,500 files of evidence, which are entirely relevant to this case." And eventually, the Foreign Office confirmed, yes, we've got 1,500 files. They're all kept at a place called Hounslow Park, which is a sort of joint compound where MI5, MI6, and the Foreign Office have this. It's just outside Milton Keynes. It's just off. It's 100 yards off the M1. Very high security compound, and they've just discovered 1,500 old Kenyan files, and a couple of Foreign Office ministers stood up and said, "Oh, actually, it's not just one. We've got 8,800 files from all over the old empire, and sorry about this, we just discovered these. They're all going to Kew. All of them are going to the National Archive, and we're appointing this very eminent historian to oversee the process." And they did, and the historian oversaw the process, took nearly all of it to Kew, to the National Archive, discovered it wasn't 8,800, it was actually just over 20,000 files that had been hidden from all around the empire, all over the empire. But what they didn't bother telling anybody at that point, the Foreign Office, was these 20,000 files were actually part of 1.2 million files that they had at the same place. And they tried to very sneakily suddenly put, they were all held unlawfully, they're held outside of the requirements of the Public Records Acts. They cannot just hold files. There's a way of lawfully holding files back. The government departments can do it. They hadn't gone through that process. They'd unlawfully held 1.2 million files. They now say, oh, it's actually 600,000. They don't really know. There's so many of them, they don't really know. And they tried to very quietly put them on a legal footing by asking Chris Grayling, the Justice Minister, to sign a piece of paper saying these are now lawfully retained. And they're now trying to figure out, we found out that it existed, this archive. They told us they'd only just found it. When I finally got into this building, I could see there's nothing to mark what it is. Inside, there's a little plaque saying it was opened in November 1992 by Alistair Goodlad, Foreign Office Minister. So it was in a purpose-built repository. So they didn't just find it, it's a purpose-built repository. It's very well equipped, very well resourced. It's very modern. And they were hiding it from the historians. And they're now saying that they're going to try and get it all over to the National Archive. But what they can't bring themselves to admit is that they just don't know how they're going to do it. It won't happen in our lifetime. It's too much work. They've got about 40 sensitivity reviewers, ex-diplomats, who are going through these, deciding what should be redacted, what should be withheld. Some of it's probably rubbish. Some of it should be just been incinerated years ago. So amongst the art, once you get into some of these papers, you can see that there is a destruction certificate showing what was destroyed in situ around the empire before it was shipped back secretly to London. And the destruction certificate showed that there was a very careful weeding process carried out as we were withdrawing from our colonial possessions, which ensured that no documents that would embarrass Her Majesty's government in any way, or any member of the armed forces or the police, would be allowed to fall into the hands of successive governments. It was a very elaborate scheme, which at points involved having two separate archives in places like Uganda and Kenya and Guyana, one which was known to, the existence of which was known to ministers of successive governments, and one which was known only to British governors. And when this happened in Uganda in the early 60s, this operation was known as Operation Legacy, and that's a term that very quickly spread around other parts of the empire. It was still going on in Borneo in the 60s, no doubt Bahrain in 71, 72. So there was a worldwide operation to destroy and to smuggle back to Britain those documents which would show our imperial mission in something less than a happy light. Remarkable, absolutely remarkable.
And where the UK hasn't destroyed the stuff, where some of the stuff that they left could be used, as in the case of Malaya, the Malay government very happily has forbidden access. I mean, they opened the archives apparently for some months. A historian by the name of Anthony Short was allowed to write a history, which is still unsurpassed as a history of the emergency, but it's out of print. You can't even find a copy of it on any of the used booksellers here. You have to look in bookshops in Singapore and hope that they can send you something online. And after he had access to the material in the Malay archives, Malaysian archives, which I'm sure were incomplete, they reclosed the archives, so there's no access to them. That's also the case, actually, with Israeli archives, which hold vast numbers of stuff, and they close and open rather randomly to whoever comes. And, of course, Palestinians, not only by virtue of being Palestinian, don't have access to it, but also by not being able to even get into the country. They, in many instances, they're specifically excluded from access to certain archives that non-Palestinians would have access to in Israel. So those are really interesting to me as well, in the sense that certainly with the former British holdings, you're having the subsequent client regimes, you know, do as you wish, because not to embarrass Britain. And so that's also in some ways preventing histories to be written. And in some cases, it's also misfortune. One of the things that is really devastating to me is that a huge amount of the stuff that we could have used for writing a history of what happened in Aden, which I think is incredibly crucial, and we know so very little about it, was destroyed in the Yemeni civil war in 1994. So these kinds of instances are also pretty devastating. These histories have been lost because of local conflict. And I just shudder to think how much has been lost in Iraq and Syria at the moment. So, and elsewhere, of course, in the Middle East.
Yeah, the Foreign Office's sort of secret archive at this place, Hounslow Park, has, as well as having destruction certificates, occasionally has some memoranda which describe the destruction process. So in Malaya, there's a description of several truckloads of documents being driven down to Singapore, where, as the author of the memo says, the Royal Navy's rather splendid incinerators were put to good use. In British Guiana, on the other hand, there's descriptions of two secretaries working around the back of Government House with one oil drum, and there's complaints that it's hot, dirty work, and you know that can we have a little bit of help? And help duly arrived in the shape of several gallons of petrol again from the Royal Navy. So, I'm not sure that sort of theft of history isn't going on today, really, and that we are having difficulty understanding the true nature of, say, British occupation of southeast Iraq, because the documentation which would allow the historians in due course to understand that will not be available in 30 years' time. I would imagine quite a lot of it is being destroyed, probably on the 25-year review period. As you know, they're supposed to be declared to the National Archive at 30 years, or a process has gone through whereby there's lawful retention of documents, and this review period happens at 25 years, and there's good reason to believe that some government departments, Ministry of Defence, for example, destroy documents on the 25-year review period, precisely because they are of historic significance.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that in the case of the US, there has been a vast outpouring of documents. Sometimes the problem is just there's too much of it, like all the FOIAs that ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, has, the Freedom of Information documents that they have managed to get various kinds of departments to release, amounts to millions of pages of documents. And I still occasionally get emails from, there's a group of us who work on various aspects of this, and I occasionally get an email from somebody who sends a juicy bit around and saying, can you believe this? This happened and we didn't know about it because nobody's actually had time to sit down and dig through these millions and millions of pages of documents, which often makes me very grateful to WikiLeaks. I don't know if you guys have ever worked with the WikiLeaks archives. They have a really good search engine. You just enter a word and it brings you up the documents you need. I really wish that somebody would do that with the ACLU Freedom of Information documents, because at the moment they're non-searchable. They're just images or PDFs that have not been OCR'd. What's OCR? Optical recognition, optical whatever. You know, where you turn an image into readable, searchable words. They haven't done that with those yet, and that's, you know, that's it's a cache that we need to go through. It's a treasure chest of information that will probably be useful, but is. You really need time and space to sit down. And things are moving so fast, one disaster after another, that we're focusing on what's going on now rather than try to go back to what happened only 10 years ago to dig it up. And I think it's necessary for us to do that, because one of the things that has been really interesting is that with the current disaster that's happening in the region, what is really striking to me is that of all the conspiracy theories about the emergence of ISIS, the one that is not a conspiracy theory, that is worth thinking about, is the fact that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the caliph, the khalif, and his top 9 or 10 deputies were all detainees in USS Camp Baqa. They were all detainees in one of the most brutal camps, actually in southern Iraq. It's in Basra now. And it's been turned into Basra Logistics City. So the Camp Baqa history has been kind of wiped by nice commercial ventures sitting on top of it. It's extraordinary. I mean, if there is a lineage to be drawn from ISIS to any other bits of the history, it is this history that has been crucial in the making of ISIS. I mean, and I think these histories are being lost. We don't have a recounting of the names of everybody who was held in Abu Ghraib. I'm not sure that they ever had a complete listing. We don't have the names of all the civilian victims in Fallujah. We don't have the names of everybody who was detained in Bagram Air Force Base. There might actually be all of that documentation somewhere out there, but they're not releasing them to us. And those are the kinds of things that certainly me, when I want to write a history, I'm looking for and finding it difficult to get a hold of.
There's the photographs, isn't there, from Abu Ghraib, at least, whereas the other detention facilities, like Camp Narna,
yes.
Balad, there were no photographs.
No.
There were no photographs. And as a result, there's no great public awareness anywhere outside of Raqqa of the existence of those places and of the awful things that
happened. Camp Narna was particularly horrible because that was McChrystal's...
And Camp Narna was particularly interesting if you're British, because the transport services into and out of Narna were provided by the British.
Oh.
And at times, the guard force was British. Camp Narna, if you were detained by the military, you went to Abu Ghraib by and large, unless you were detained by special forces, in which case you went to a place called Camp Narna, which was on the corner of Baghdad International Airport, or Saddam Hussein International Airport, as it was before the invasion. And then that was closed down, and another place was opened, a place called Balad, which I think about 50 or 60 miles north of Baghdad. And yeah, the helicopters that were flying people in and out of those places were run by a British special forces operation. They were essentially RAF and British... an army air force, British army helicopters, and some of the guard force on occasion were British. There's a chap I know who was I have to be careful what I say now. He was a member of this British special forces unit, and he described how he would go on sentry duty in a sangha, as they call it, on top of this very large pyramid type structure. And he and his friends would, his colleagues would stag on, as he said, they would be on sentry duty. And he said some of them would look out, they were told to look out towards the wire, towards the perimeter. And he'd turn around and look inside. And he, because he knew there was a row, two rows actually, of what he called dog kennels. Cells about so high in which men were being held. And he said some of his fellow British sentries were so horrified and frightened and by... this terrible moral dilemma that they found themselves in of having to find themselves detaining such people. They couldn't turn around and look. He'd say to them, come, just look, they're only 50 yards away. And these young RAF aircraft men would say, no, I'm not turning around, I can't look at it. They wouldn't look. And because they were so horrified, and they were so frightened about what they'd been come involved in. And of course, but we don't know about Camp Narna. We don't know much about it. I've tried to pause on Camp Narna, but we don't know much about it. We haven't got the photographs. We haven't. This same chap saw a Navy SEAL get his camera out once, and the guy was arrested within nanoseconds, you know, driven away.
This is where General Stanley McChrystal ran his operations for the great majority of, actually, the duration of the US occupation of Iraq. General McChrystal is now a professor at Yale. How many people were killed there? No, yes. Petraeus has got a nice professorship at CUNY. So, yeah, they do their indiscretions, they do their murders, they do their whatever they need to do, and then they get nice little appointments to good U.S. universities.
So time is marching on. And I hope that there's plenty of people in the audience who've got some very good, maybe difficult questions. Is anybody?
Yes.
Yes.
It was such a discursive, touching on so many subjects,
yes,
that I think you tried to paint with a too broad brush. And I think a lot of the incidents and crises are not all part of the one thing. They're discrete from one another in all sorts of respects. For example, the national opposition in Kenya was a phrase used in connection with Jomo Kenyatta. Wasn't national opposition at all. Kenya, like the rest of Africa, is deeply divided on a tribal basis, and the Kikuyu, who Kenyatta was fighting for, not Kenya and everybody, inclusive nation, he was fighting for Kikuyu interests, and the Kikuyu Mau Mau killed more of other tribes, the Luo, for example, the Maasai, and other people who weren't Kikuyu, and what's more, they killed more Kikuyu who weren't favouring Mau Mau than they did any British settlers or anything like that. So you've got to look at the particulars of each one of these places before you can say, oh, these were baddies and those were goodies, and draw a breath. Another example, Northern Ireland. You can't equate what was going on in Northern Ireland with what was going on in Kenya or Cyprus, that sort of thing. That, again, is drawing a too broad brush. And I don't know a single civilization of whatever ideological persuasion in the last 100, 150 years that hasn't done all of the things that you attribute to America, Britain, or whatever. It's our rotten humanity, the wickedness of people, whoever they are. And there are no great goodies or no great baddies, except a few exceptions at the moment, like the Palestinians, who are putting up a real fight. And I'd wish, when I assisted a former sergeant in the Palestine Police Force, he's now dead, a man called Jim Sawyer, who was active in trying to chase Menachem Begin and his gang, who strung up two British sergeants in the eucalyptus groves near Netanya, hanged them with piano wire, cheese wire, and mined their bodies so that when people came along to cut those boys down, they would be blown up too. Now, Menachem Begin came over here in 1977 as Prime Minister of Israel, and the British government hadn't withdrawn its wanted notice for Menachem Begin. So Jim says, I was a police officer serving the Crown, and I tried to arrest that man. That warrant is still valid. I will go to Bristol, where the family of Mervyn Pace, one of the two people that were killed, and go before a magistrate, show them Menachem Begin's book, The Revolt, where he says, yes, I did it, and I do it all again, and ask for Menachem Begin to be arrested. The court considered all Jim's information, and they refused his application, and they refused to give a reason why. And did the Guardian cover that? An important incident there? No, it didn't. So there's no, I won't take any holier-than-thou stuff from the Guardian. In Northern Ireland, again, it's different and discreet from the other things. How do you expect people to react to people fighting an asymmetric warfare, terrorism, let's use the word terrorism, when they've got the vote? And I think revolts and terrorism by people who have not got the vote, have not got any opening for their views, is justifiable and acceptable, like the Palestinian resistance now. But to equate the IRA and the Irish Republican movement, who resorted to terrorism rather than political action, is a nonsense. So, though I'm looking forward to reading your book, madam, but really, I hope in your book you don't draw as broad a brush as you've used at this meeting. Thank you.
If I may say something, I don't think either of us said anything about goodies or baddies. I don't think that I'm necessarily saying anybody here is walking out with a particular kind of clean hands, or I'm necessarily interested in drawing lines or putting people under those categories. What I'm interested in my book, and what I think Ian does beautifully in his book, is the way that certain practices that we see currently our military, our government engage in, have particular roots in the past. Yes, I completely and totally agree that the settler colonial situation in Kenya is very different than the situation in Cyprus, and the Cyprus is very different than Aden. They were all very discrete contexts. I know enough about the particular histories. I know enough about the particular kinds of internal fissures to also recognize that, yes, there were a lot of internal killings going on in Kenya, but elsewhere as well. I didn't say anything. I didn't say there weren't. What I'm talking about is that while we claim the mantle of rights, we claim the mantle of virtue, we preach and lecture everybody else about their human rights or about their abuse of human rights. We claim to be fighting the good war here and there. We brag about these kinds of things. And there is actually a hidden history behind this, which we don't often talk about. And that hidden history is what I think we need to talk about. We need to recognize. When I was doing my interviews, absolutely everybody I was speaking to was actually talking about Baden-Endorf as the model that we should be using, because that's how you do interrogations. Nobody's ever hurt. Nobody ever dies. The British knew how to do it. But of course, in reality, what was happening, people were being starved to death, or people were being beaten with lashes. They weren't goodies. They were fascists in some cases. They were Waffen-SS in other cases. But then we can't go about claiming that somehow we treated everybody well, even when they were bastards. It doesn't wash. I mean, that doesn't work in that way. And I think part of what is really significant about the particular kind of history we've got is that, as you may recall, at the very beginning I said that we claim to be doing everything according to Geneva Conventions or whatnot, and we're not. And I made a distinction between the way that we manage our prisons in counterinsurgencies and the way, say, the Russians do in Chechnya, where I said they just go in and kill everybody. I do make that distinction. I think there are distinctions to be made. But I also don't think that we're some sort of a shining beacon of human rights, or have been ever, ever in the course of our imperial history. What is interesting about Northern Ireland in particular is the way that General Kitson, who commanded actually the UK counterinsurgency in Northern Ireland, had just come from Aden. He had had Kenyan and Cyprus experiences. He specifically talks about using those experiences, and he specifically says that he was told you cannot use the methods that you used in Kenya and Aden in Northern Ireland because they're not black. That was what it was said. And so what you have to do is you have to use, and he says this, I really highly recommend Kitson's book because it's so open. He says what we need to do is use the veneer of law behind which we can do what we need to do. I mean, the fact is that we have to recognize, as I said, there are no goodies and baddies in this story. The story is about a state. It's about a state that claims to be doing a virtuous war, and it's far from engaged in any kind of virtue, any kind of rights, or any kind of protection. Yes?
Have you done any work, either one of you, about, let's say, the connection of U.S. or Britain with what's happening in Saudi Arabia, because we really don't hear much about what's going on in that country. And I know there are pockets of voices which are very much suppressed, and I doubt it's only done organically. Can you shed some light on that? Robert Baer, ex-CIA guy, has written some work on the subject. And I was just wondering, I'd appreciate your take on that.
I just saw a piece about U.S. bases in the Middle East. In the U.K., I cannot speak about the relations. The relations there are old and dodgy in all sorts of ways, as are the U.S. relations. But I was just reading a piece about U.S. bases in the Middle East, and apparently, although after 1991, after actually 1993 Khobar bombings, the U.S. supposedly pulled back its military and closed the bases in Saudi Arabia. There are a number of places that are ostensibly operating under... they're not U.S. bases. There are Saudi bases in which U.S. military people are placed and who are ostensibly engaged in training and advising, which I think there's probably a lot more going on. Also recently, there has been some reports on 3 secret drone bases, which for a space of maybe 2 or 3 days could be seen on Google Maps, and then they were erased from Google Maps. So there are some drone bases that are in Rub al Khali in the empty quarter, from which apparently U.S. flies drones to Yemen to do some of the killings in Yemen. Whether it's engaged in any kind of direct suppression inside the country itself, I imagine not. I imagine that the U.S. is much more interested in using Saudi Arabia as a kind of a base to do operations in Yemen and elsewhere. U.S. also has bases in Djibouti. It has bases in Oman. It has bases in Qatar and Kuwait and Emirates and Bahrain. It has bases in Pakistan. It has several bases, apparently secret bases in Israel. So, it's pretty much everywhere there. And I think the one that we know the least about, perhaps because there are the fewest reporters there, is Saudi Arabia. Well, and Israel, probably.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for what you had to say, because I very much enjoyed what you had to say.
Thank you.
Picking up on what the gentleman said in front of me, and I'm quite concerned that you mentioned about Britain and Israel possibly being the best of the world and intelligence and, of course, torturing and obviously gathering intelligence in relation to that. When we look at Britain as a nation over the past 200 years and look at our history and the fact that Britain's empire covered a third of the globe, furthermore, the fact of what we experienced during the 19th century throughout Afghanistan, India, across South Africa, and when we look at that as a whole, we move forward to post-war and we look at Malaya, Borneo, and as you rightly raised, the secret war that took place in Aden, and then moving on to the issues in Kenya. I think it's quite right that we move forward and look at what the IRA did, and we look at, particularly over the past 40 years, what we've suffered as a nation. Quite clearly, we had no choice. This was not a matter where we had to look at this and carefully decide how we dealt with terrorists. We were forced into a position in how to interrogate, move forward, gather that intelligence in that particular way. I think, respectfully, you've overlooked that.
Perhaps I can try to answer that. The war's been over, that horrible little war has been over, largely, touch wood, for, 16 years, coming on for 17 years. Up until 98, the IRA, as far as I'm concerned, were an appalling organisation who were determined to subvert democracy, to impose their will on the majority of Northern Ireland through some really quite barbaric acts, Enniskillen, Warrington, proxy bombings. Since then, I have taken the view that it makes sense to try and find out more about who our enemy was and why they behaved the way they did. And what I've found from talking to people who were in the IRA surprised me. They would describe themselves as terrorists sometimes, but would make the point, look, Ian, we didn't all wake up one day and decide we're going to be bad people and we're going to start killing people and we're going to go over to England and start blowing people up. We didn't do it because we were bad. And I didn't realise until I started talking to them the extent to which they think they were fighting a defensive war. They didn't regard it as an offensive action. They thought they were defending themselves against a very oppressive state. One of the things that drove people to join the IRA, we all know, was Bloody Sunday. But we recruited lots of people to the IRA through the introduction of internment and through the way in which we treated people once we were interned, through the use of the 5 techniques, through torturing people. We encouraged people to believe that they had no real choice. And there's a guy I know called Tommy McKerney who was an IRA murderer. He went to jail for life for one killing in 1977, I think it was. It was appalling what he did. He shot a postman who was going about his business because the postman was also a part-time soldier. And he ended up being interrogated by the police at Castlereagh, and he said he was tortured. I happen to believe him because I know some of the people who are on the other side of the room, on the other side of the desk. I know some of the interrogators. And they twisted his body into all sorts of awful positions and just very patiently held it there for a couple of hours. And Tommy eventually went off. He was convicted on the basis of his confession. He went off. He was weighed off for life. He served 16 years. He left the IRA whilst in prison. After 10 years in prison, he went to his commanding officer in the IRA and said, I'm not a volunteer anymore. I don't agree with this anymore. So then he came out and he said that he's a law-abiding citizen. He's a productive citizen. So you could say that what happened to Tommy in the way in which he was treated served a real purpose, had a real utility. This man who was killing individuals, taken out of circulation. And he went to jail for a long time, and by the time he came out, he was no longer going to kill anybody he'd seen since. On the other hand, Tommy McKerney would say that that what we did to him created... He's quite an articulate guy. He said, you created a reservoir of hatred. And we knew that our brothers and our cousins and our neighbours and our workmates were being tortured and being mistreated. One of the reasons why we joined the IRA was because of that. He joined the IRA when he was waiting to go to Queen's University, when he saw, on the opening day of internment, he saw fellow villagers being dragged away and beaten to be locked up without trial. And he said, you created this reservoir of hatred. And he said, I'm really concerned that there are Irish children who aren't born yet who are still going to be drinking from that reservoir of hatred of the British because of the way we treat. So I think it's worth us considering thinking carefully about what we did during that war, as well as what the IRA did, and to the extent to which we created the conditions that resulted in that conflict continuing, and the confinement of, without trial, of 300 and odd people. There's actually almost 2,000 people before we gave up on that in 1975. That added to the conflict. That led to people joining the IRA. I don't know if that answers your question. That's how I would like to answer it.
This gentleman in the front has had his hand up.
Hi, thanks. First of all, thanks for a very interesting talk. I wanted to ask a question about the relationship between a society being liberal and the kind of phenomena that you describe. Just following on from the exchange earlier and also the content of the talk, I wondered if it might be helpful to distinguish the phenomena that you were documenting and how those phenomena are justified. And it seemed to me that you were talking about a very liberal way of justifying those phenomena with the suggestion that there's a lot of hypocrisy in that. But I wondered, can you say anything about whether the phenomena themselves have any kind of a connection with the society being liberal? Is there any real distinction there between the kind of torture or internment or what have you that you describe and that carried on by societies which we wouldn't categorise as liberal?
I think that the big distinction is the states that don't have any claim to liberality fight their wars often without the worry of the veneer of law, for example, which I mentioned earlier. Again, it's interesting to me that the two examples that I often use as a kind of a counter position are the Russians in Chechnya, where it was essentially they used scorched earth methods in order to suppress the insurgency there, and the way in which the government of Sri Lanka destroyed the LTTE's insurgency. And not just the insurgency, but also the after effects on the civilian populations in large swathes of the country. So those are two examples. I think I'm not sure that this is so much about a hypocrisy. I think that there is a fundamental way in which liberal states fight war, which claims virtue for the war, claims that it's being fought for humanitarian reasons, or to bring democracy, or to bring humanity, or to bring liberation, or to bring freedom. And rather interestingly, if you go back to the 19th century writings of some of the great liberal thinkers in Britain, for example, John Stuart Mill or Bentham, you'll find them referring again and again to the inadequacy of the mental development of the colonial subject, which required instruction, which required introduction to law, which required time in order for them to grow up enough to be capable of self-government. The other liberal thinker that I'm really interested in the 19th century, which Americans tend to valorize, is de Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, who most people know his Democracy in America as a wonderful ethnographic account of the U.S. What they often don't know about him is that when in 1948 the French invaded Algeria, occupied Algeria, and they used the razzia methods, complete destruction, scorched earth, killings of women and children, pushing them into caves and smoking them out, etc., etc., etc. De Tocqueville went into the parliament and said that this is what needs to be done because the Arabs only understood the language of force and this is the way civilization was going to be brought to them. So I think that there is a particular way in which this is, and again, it was posed in the language of civilization, right? It's, you know, they're uncivilized and we're civilizing them. And the way we're civilizing them is through the use of violence. But then the violence is supposed to fit within a particular channel, and what those channels are administration, it's law, it's supposedly good governance. But what good governance does is, for example, hands power to good local clients. What administration does is it maintains hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions of records of everything so that it can be mined for intelligence but not open to scrutiny. What, for example, the rule of law does is to provide an alibi for power. So I think it's those two things are distinct. Again, it's really important to recognize that this introduction of liberal counterinsurgency is an improvement, if you will, on the mass slaughter that in the 19th century used to be the method of conquest. But on the other hand, there is something disingenuous about the ways in which there is a claim of virtue in the way we fight those wars. Okay, we don't go off on mass slaughter, we don't go off and raise the ground like they did in Grozny, but, you know, we use the law in these really dodgy ways. And I think it's my duty as a citizen of an ostensible democracy to keep my government's feet to fire about these things.
Fascinating, and I'm looking forward to reading the book about why this is, why it should be liberal, because what I'm understanding from this is that from Ian's book, it actually what was first discovered in the London cage was this: these methods are actually the most effective. It's more effective than torturing someone until they die. It's more effective now to waterboard somebody in Guantanamo nearly 200 times than giving him and torturing him until he doesn't give in. He just broken completely. So what seems to be the thread through our British history is that these are the methods that actually are effective, and there's a mismatch between when we're being preachy and you know, the convention of torture, not extraditing Abu Hamza because the evidence in Jordan was extracted under torture, therefore unreliable. So on one hand, we're being preachy and saying we mustn't do this because it's unreliable. On the other hand, what we've shown through our history and what we keep on doing is that it is effective. And what, you know, how can we do this? How can we stop this happening if the countries that do it seem to be above the law because they don't sign up to the ICC because they just think they can get away with it?
We're getting away with it.
We are. We will. We continue to get away with it.
Yeah. So it doesn't have anything to do with signing the ICC at this point.
Sorry, it doesn't have any...
It doesn't have anything to do with signing the ICC and signing up to the ICC at this point.
But it's the same thing happening in Israel, haven't ICC. But what is the way out of this?
Difficult to say. I would imagine the only way the only way that we could potentially influence our governments is to constantly be vigilant, to constantly keep their feet to fire, and there's a point at which it's our job as citizens to do this. But often when these wars are fought elsewhere, there will be a backlash. There will be violence there. And we have to just recognize that everything that we do will have echoes, as Ian said, through the generations. I'm also not 100% persuaded that these methods are entirely effective. A lot of the dodgy intelligence that came out of Well, for example, the fact that Saddam Hussein supposedly had met with Al-Qaeda person, or one of somebody from his government had met with somebody from Al-Qaeda, came out through these five methods. I don't know how effective they are if they produce the lie that, and, well, that was used as a justification for going to war in 2003. So I'm not 100% persuaded that they're effective, but even if they are effective, ultimately I hope that we can make the moral stand that this, they're not right.
Yeah. I wanted first to endorse the point that Ian made about the IRA, because there was a time when the sections of the Catholic population were complaining to the IRA about their lack of action to defend the community, and the IRA was said that it stood for I ran away. So there's a complex relationship there between a community demanding protection from Protestant paramilitaries, from the British Army, from what began in the 60s as ethnic cleansing of certain areas, of a cleansing of Catholic families. And there's all that background to the IRA. But what I also wanted to bring in is I think there's a parallel thread of history that you've not included, because the Naomi Klein in The Shock Doctrine writes about the CIA funding psychiatric experiments in Canada in the, I think, the 1950s, about how you empty somebody's mind or how you get information out of it. And the Americans have been pursuing that for a long, long time, to the point where they're coming up with waterboarding. And so, and there's a kind of crossover there. Dan Mitrione, who you probably know about, who was the kind of guru of torture in the States, who described torture as a fine art and wrote at some length about it. He talks about the importance of a psychological evaluation and a medical examination before you begin the interrogation. So again, there's an echo of that same procedure of the involvement of the doctors. The School of the Americas that was training the police and the army across Latin America was not only preoccupied with interrogation and counterinsurgency, it was a form of population control. The whole Operation Condor, the support of the military dictatorships across Latin America, was a different form of controlling whole populations through state terror. And I think they had a term for what, when you talked about the villages and the repopulation, depopulation, they talked about draining the ocean, which was based on something Mao Zedong said about the guerrilla's relationship to the people being that of the fish in the ocean. So if you drain the ocean, you isolate the fish, and then you can go after the guerrillas. I'm interested in what the connection is that you see between those two different threads, because they seem very clearly to be linked up, and the British and the Americans have very much come together on the latest project in the Middle East. But there's also a sense that they've been very much together for a long time.
In the U.S., there are three threads. One is the stuff that the soldiers do, and it passes through sort of vernacular, through sort of soldierly histories in their regiments, groups, divisions, whatever. So for example, the water cure was used in the Philippines, and it is something that they're about, which there are songs that apparently are sung at veterans' parties or whatnot down the line. So that's one thread. The other thread, of course, is the sensory deprivation experiments, Kubark manual, and various other kinds of CIA manuals, which are far more thought through and sophisticated. And they are arriving at forms of torture that do not leave marks and are often a sort of a form of thinking. And then there's a third, which is the kind of borrowings from everybody else. And there's an amazing book on torture by a U.S. academic called Rijali, which is called Torture and Democracy, in which he documents exhaustively all the different kinds of torture that pass around. One of the things that's really interesting to me is that Battle of Algiers, which opens with a scene of torture of an Algerian by the French, made by communists, Guillo Pontecorvo, was actually shown in the Pentagon before the invasion of Iraq. they read it as a manual of how to do things rather than as a how not to do things. So these learnings from the others is really important. Actually, maybe there's a fourth one as well, and that's something that they learned after the Korean War. After the Korean War, when a lot of Americans were apparently subjected to torture by the Koreans or the Chinese, they came back, and both the U.S. military and the U.K. devised methods of resistance to torture. SEER, in the case of the U.S., I can't remember what the acronym is in the case of the U.S. I don't know what the acronym is in the case of
the U.S. R2I, is it?
Something.
Yeah,
it's some. Anyway, resistance, so what they. Yeah, and so they do. So they train the soldiers about how to actually resist should they be captured by an enemy force. And when 2001 invasion of Afghanistan happened, they actually brought in people to teach them how to reverse engineer the SEER, so essentially take the methods of torture and use them on detainees. So there are these different routes at which they come, and where it's used and who uses it, there are different methods for that.
Well, there were studies of brainwashing, academic
yes.
studies in
oh,
the
yes.
States.
Absolutely. In Canada in particular, yeah, McGill University. They had sensory tanks in which people actually went mad. Injections of all sorts of drugs which resulted in schizophrenia in people. There's horrifying. You actually write about some of this history in there, which is astonishing. So.
They're also reputed to have spirited away a few high-ranking Gestapo people at the end of World War II.
I'm sure that was also the case.
To pick their brains on torture and interrogation as well.
You must read Ian's book. Ian's book is amazing on torture stuff.
Thanks. Is this on?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Thank you.
Excellent talk.
Thank you.
And I have, I think, two interrelated questions. And the first being that actually through the body of work that you've published and that you're currently working on, what comes through as well as these kinds of logics of incarceration and detention is also the kind of illogical sense of it. So the ways in which surprise and irregularity can become very key to the control of populations. And I think especially as you scale up, so thinking about Gaza and the West Bank as spaces of detention as well. So I was wondering if you could reflect on that a bit. And then also, what are the implications of that kind of irregularization for you in terms of research, both of you? Because there's there probably is a lack of documentation that accompanies that.
I want to talk about it's our uncertainty is an incredibly, incredibly potent weapon. And I'll tell you a personal experience. I grew up in Iran. My parents were communists and political prisoners in Iran. And once they came out of prison, their passports were confiscated, and so we couldn't travel. When it was time for me to go to university, they decided to send me to the U.S., and I had to sort of travel. And what was amazing was that was the mechanisms that were used to control all of these stages by the state were mechanisms which you could not anticipate. So when, for example, my parents were imprisoned, the only way that they could get out of prison was if my grandfather put forward the deed, the title deed to his house as a bail. They wouldn't accept cash bail or any such thing. It would have to be a title deed to somebody's house. And then you don't have a court date. Or they give you a date, you go to the court, they meet you with you for 10 minutes, and then they say, oh, come back, and we'll tell you when to come back. And so you're living your life in a kind of a state of suspension and anticipation, and there is nothing that can keep you controlled better than not knowing what can happen when. This sense of anticipation is really kind of, it's an incredibly effective disciplining mechanism. I suspect that a lot of that is also at work, certainly in the document, in the manuals for interrogation and the memoranda written by the U.S. Justice Department in which they put a rubber stamp on various CIA methods. One of the things that jumps out is the CIA demanding people being kept uncertain and disoriented at the moment of arrest, because there's nothing like that disorientation to help in breaking them down. As you say, you can scale that up all the way to Gaza. People in Gaza are constantly in a state of suspension over when the next weapon is going to, when the next bombs are going to be released over their head, and the drones consistently 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, buzzing over their heads is a way in which they're being disciplined into obeying and into being made to obey, although they're of course not. They're not obeying. The fact that they keep going again and again and again is perhaps a testament to the fact that this is not working, but it must be an extraordinarily devastating thing to be subjected to psychologically. Ian's an amazing investigative journalist. He has ways and methods we all wish for. I'll let him explain how he gets to material.
There are various means of. You asked about the difficulty of obtaining documentation, didn't you? And last year, I came across the existence of these 1.2 million Foreign Office files whilst making inquiries about the absence of Ministry of Defence files from the National Archive, particularly those relating to Northern Ireland. And eventually I realised that the Ministry of Defence sort of confessed that they had 66,000 files in an archive in Derbyshire which were being held unlawfully. And they said, but we've just got we haven't got the staff, it's an administrative problem. They admitted to it. I found myself talking to the guy who ran the place. I said to him, can I come and have a look around? He said, no, you can't do that. And I said, well, can you describe it to me? And he said, well, do you remember the scene at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark where there's a big warehouse? I said, yeah, vaguely. Yeah. He said, well, I've got two of those, he said. But I made a mistake. I reported on the Ministry of Defence holding 66,000 files completely unlawfully outside of the provisions of the Public Records Act. I'm learning that whenever government officials, whenever the British state reveals something under pressure, shows you something it clearly would rather not, what you should do is say to yourself, what is that a distraction from? So when I was taken to the Foreign Office's archive, that secret archive at Hounslow Park in Buckinghamshire, and there was this building, it was like a big pyramid, I didn't realise there was another building. There was another building that they didn't tell me anything about, and I had to really badger them to let me in there. The 66,000 files that the Ministry of Defence was holding was quite interesting, really. You could see that they were trying to downplay the number of files that were there from Northern Ireland. I've just since discovered that the reason why there's two vast warehouses is because there's not 66,000 files, there's rather more than that. There's rather more than the Foreign Office's 1.2 million, in fact. And they have been put on a legal footing. They are on a legal footing because the Minister of Defence has realised that the process they need to go through in order to obtain authorisation to do this is so flimsy that they can just provide schedules of masses of documents, and the authorisations provided. Authorisations have been provided by the shelf, they've told, and the people who are providing the authorisations. There's a committee at the National. Forgive me. There's probably people in the audience who know far more about this than I do. There's a committee at the National Archive and Kew called the Lord Chancellor's Advisory Council, which is made up of ex-diplomats, librarians, archivists, retired intelligence officers, who are expected to look at every application by a government department to retain documents. They give approval or they don't. Once they've given approval, the Lord Chancellor, Justice Secretary, provides what's known as an LCI, Lord Chancellor's Instrument, and it's then lawfully retained. The Ministry of Defence realised that this process is very easy. They can just go through it and add a whole schedule, a few more million documents, and that they are held lawfully. None of them appear on the National Archive website. None of them appear in the catalogue. We don't know much of what's in there. But there are inventories. So there's 8.5 million. I haven't reported this to the Guardian yet because I only just discovered they've got 8.5 million files that they're holding in the Ministry of Defence, going back decades. 8.5 million. And we don't quite know what's in there. We don't know quite. But I think it's a tremendous game, really, trying to find out more about these matters and trying to put more of them into the public domain. They've got a very high-level inventory. There's different levels of cataloguing inventories, I understand. I don't know much about record-keeping. The very highest-level one is called a collation. It's called a collation, which I've got here. So you can get these.
There's a geographer called Trevor Paglen whose most recent project is about invisible places and invisible things and gaps in how you research them. So, for example, as you know, most governments have a classified segment of their budget which goes to various intelligence things. What he's done is by putting together the US budget when it's released is like a telephone directory, for those who know what it is, repeating your joke. It is about this big and this thick. It is upwards of 2,000 pages. And what he's sat down is by matching line item to line item to line item, discovered the gaps in the budget, the holes in the budget, to figure out exactly what the classified amounts are. He has worked with astronomers in order to track spy satellites, and by the route of spy satellites, figure out what kind of intelligence there were, the route and density of spy satellites, figure out which kind of intelligence they're looking for. He has gone to U.S. bases in the states in the West and counted lamps and the number, the density of electricity to figure out where the bases are. So there are ways of doing it. I think you have to be kind of a creative lateral thinker.
I'd like to ask a question to Ian. I'll ask the same question to Lally, is it? Perhaps in a couple of years, but the reason I wanted to ask Ian is that you published your book roughly 2 years ago, is that right? And I bought it when I came to a similar meeting in this room, read it, and apart from the presentation on the evening, found the book jaw-dropping in terms of what you dug up, and I felt you did identify trends and a sort of continuity that frightened the hell out of me in the sense it was showing that there was very little difference between the behavior of governments from one, you know, period to another. Mm. And certainly, you know, truth and information wasn't as available as it should be. So I found it very impressive, and it was an education to me, and hopefully will be for young lawyers, civil servants, military officers, and the general public the future. But in terms of your own perspective, when you must feel sort of angry or feel that, you know, things haven't been done correctly over time, do you get any satisfaction from what's happening as a result of your book now? I mean, do you see any difference in how government treats you, the military treats you? Do you see any little battles that somehow you feel have been won through the book you've written? Or do you see it very much as a long-term project?
I was asked this question a while ago, and I gave an answer which was a complete cop-out, really, which was say, well, I'm a reporter, my job is just to try and figure out what's going on around me and to package up that understanding into a news article or a book and put it out into the public domain and hope that it helps the public to understand a little bit more about. So I don't have to worry about consequences. But of course we do. We all worry about consequences. We all we are all concerned about the way in which this country of ours is seen elsewhere and the way in which it conducts itself at times of emergency, and sometimes perceived emergency rather than real emergency. So, yes, it is a little frustrating, although there's a couple of things that are going on now, which I don't think a lot of people realise that there's actually a Scotland Yard investigation into the UK's involvement in rendition and torture. It's called Operation Lid. It's been going on since, I think, January 2012, according to a statement that the Crown Prosecution Service put on its website. It was embarked upon after the Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, as he was, wrote to Bernard Hogan Howe, Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, and said, you must investigate this matter. And this matter was the discovery of a number of documents in Tripoli during the revolution in September 2011, in which a senior British intelligence officer had put his signature to a letter in which he admitted that the British were involved in the kidnap and rendition to torture of two Libyan families. And that's still going on. The police reported now with the Crown Prosecution Service. Will charges be brought against the prime suspects, who are Jack Straw, Sir Mark Allen? Don't hold your breath, is what I say. You know, this is Britain, after all. So is that frustrating, or do I just have to acknowledge that that's the way that's the way we are. I don't know. I'm sorry. Does that answer the question?
Or? No, I think journalists and academics fulfil the role you've just said at the minimum, that's for sure. But one always takes some satisfaction if somehow, somewhere along the line, I mean, in the Watergate case, those journalists got rid of a president. Now, that didn't necessarily achieve a lot, but it was certainly a major outcome of a sort. One kind of hopes that your sort of portrait and others will have some sort of impact as it deserves.
Well, I think there is a growing understanding in the UK that we've been up to our neck in really awful things since 9/11 and since 7/7, and that British forces didn't conduct themselves in southeast Iraq in a way which we might hope that they would. There's a great many people in the UK don't care, I suspect, but then there are others who do, and just that public knowledge, that public awareness is kind of a consequence in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, except people still use the word terrorist, which I feel is a word that almost has no meaning to me. It's highly imprecise, and usually terrorists in one era become heroes in the next, which is usually fully justified in Mandela and other examples.
Yes.
My supervisor used to say that terror is a tactic, so you can't really learn anything by calling somebody a terrorist because it says nothing about what they're fighting for. It just says how they're fighting. And I think that's absolutely true. I think it reveals nothing except for the anger of the person who says the word. So.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk. Have a look at Freeword and their events, and also visit Vim's events. And thank you again to our amazing speakers.
Thank you very much.
One last plug. It's a very good book, and there's a few copies outside, I think.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.